All right. What is going on, everybody? You're listening to Expanded Perspectives with me, Cam, and joining me as always, es mi amigo, Mr. Kyle Filson.
How's it going out there, everybody?
Philly, how are you doing, my friend?
I'm doing good.
We're really excited to knock this out, folks. We're really pumped up. We're actually jumping on it a little bit earlier than normal because you're getting this recording. If you're hearing this on Monday, we're recording this Saturday evening. We are trying to get this done and preparing for the UFC coming up. We're trying to get ready for the Robbie Lawler, Johnny Hendricks rematch for the belt and Anthony Pettis, Gilbert Melendez. Yeah. I'm beside myself. I cannot wait for this fight.
I've been busy all day. I started out this morning having to work, and then we've been doing some Christmas shopping, visiting Santa, hanging lights, and now we're doing the podcast, and then we're going to watch the fight. So it's been a really busy day. I'm super excited. It's almost over. It's almost time to crack those cold ones and relax.
I can't wait.
Job well done.
Yeah, I'm really. It's going to be a really, really great card. Hope everybody had a wonderful and outstanding weekend.
Yeah, I mean, we got a really good show tonight. We got some interesting guests on.
Yes, we do.
Dealing specifically with the paranormal. Yes. We don't have too many paranormal people on this show, so it's nice whenever we get a chance to do that.
It was fun. A great bunch of guys to talk to. But you were telling me a little something before we got going. We're going to jump into the news right quick.
Sure.
You were giving me some Bigfoot information, and it's funny because I had seen some photographs of this. I don't really know how to feel about it, but it's believable. I mean, it's kind of strange.
are you referring to the horses?
Yes. Yeah. The reason I say that is because it always makes me think of even the stories of the little people, some of my favorite stories. And then you start getting into this braiding like this. So lay it on me, bro.
Well, that's right. And that's the only other place I've ever heard of this, like, hair braiding stuff happening is when it comes to, like, fae folk or fairy stories, you know, nature spirits or something like that. But this comes from BigfootEvidence.com, and it's titled, "Do Bigfoot Really Braid Horses' Hair?" Now, Dr. Melba Ketchum, everybody knows who she is, claims that Bigfoot periodically sneak into her ranch and braids her horse's hair. Now, Michigan BFRO researcher Jim Sherman heard about this and decided to look into this strange phenomenon. Now, he writes, "After hearing about the possibility of a horse letting a Sasquatch braid its mane, I figured it was important to research what might be the cause of the braiding. Was a Sasquatch to blame? Were they a hoax? Or was it simply a natural thing that sometimes happens to horses? I spoke with horse owners and visited a farm to watch a horse's mane get braided. I also did more research on the subject than necessary, and I added some of that as well. Spoiler alert. It seems like many of the cases of braiding may be caused by horses grooming themselves."
I gotcha.
Guess you don't even have to watch the video. Now, there's a video on YouTube if you want to watch it. But the background videos, most of it was taken from a ground blind near where some of the horses lived in Michigan. The horse in the thumbnail was not one of those I researched. It's just, it reminded me of that horse. Anyways, it's a video, a secret video showing horses groom themselves. And they saying that just the grooming can sometimes cause hair to be braided. But now the pictures that they show.
That doesn't look like grooming spots to me.
No. This is the pictures they show. These are braided manes.
Yeah.
You can't lick your tongue with a horse's tongue and make it braid. I mean, it's crisscross pattern like you see girls braid their hair.
And some of it's tied and things like that. Look, and a horse doesn't bend properly to braid its own mane.
No.
I understand grooming. Look, I mean, we've owned horses. I get that. But
that's what I'm saying to the outsider. I'm not saying that horses can't tangle hair and make it look where it looks braided. But the images that they're showing of the people that have the braided manes, that's not done by horse grooming.
I don't know
what it is. Yeah. Now, is it a hoax? Very easily, I could take pictures of a braided mane and say, look, every week I come out, something's braiding my horse's hair.
Why would they? Why would a Bigfoot do that, I wonder?
I have no idea. See, that's the problem. And my other problem is, why would you automatically assume it was Bigfoot doing it? You know what I mean?
Like, if it's the fae?
It could be it. Maybe it's extraterrestrials. Maybe it's ghosts. Maybe it's Tokalachis. I mean, who knows what it is? Why would you immediately just go, it's got to be Bigfoot doing it?
True.
Well, that's Dr. Melba Ketchum, though.
Yeah.
Now, remember years ago when she was doing all the DNA studying on that, I really looked into it. I was like, man, this is a real scientist with a real good pedigree, and she's really taking it serious. But now it seems like she's kind of, I don't know, a little strange out.
Allegedly stretching the truth.
That's what it seems like to me.
Yeah. Anyways. Yeah. I got something you're going to love, Brad.
Okay.
Have you ever given any thought to how much money it actually takes to have a naval sub force?
Like a naval submarine fleet?
Yeah, like a fleet of subs.
Geez.
Could you imagine?
Well,
you're thinking of the cutbacks. You're thinking of what we're doing.
I mean, there's
now.
No way I would know, could estimate that, but I imagine it's a lot.
Like a lot.
Billions every year?
Well, and imagine the reason I say that is the same thing with the Air Force, you know, when we're talking about that. And that's kind of one of the reasons they brought the drones in, were because it was unmanned, autonomous, and it was a whole lot cheaper than building planes over and over and over when you have to just, you could build a bunch of drones.
Right. Yeah. Well, and like the last show, was it the Elite show? We were talking about the, what was the machine? The drone that was for the helping ambulance. Heart attacks.
The AED.
AED, yeah, yeah, right?
Yeah.
It's a drone, and that's kind of that too.
Well, exactly right. Well, Patrick Tucker from DefenseOne.com wrote a great article, and the minute I saw it, instantly I had to think of you, of course, as it says, why eel drones are the future of naval warfare.
Eel
this
drones?
This looks... Remember the
like E-E-L?
Yes.
An eel?
Yes.
Okay, I'm making sure you... I thought you said ill.
Ill.
An ill drone.
An ill drone. No, no, it's not ill. Sam Worthington and Christian Bale, is it Terminator Salvation?
Man, I don't remember that.
You remember when they pull that water, looks like a big eel, but it's like a water Terminator that they pull up at.
Uh-huh.
You remember when they get that
yes.
out of there?
Okay, I know
that's what
about.
This looks like. They're using it now, and it says in the decade ahead, unmanned underwater vehicles, or UUVs, may have the same sort of disruptive effects on militaries as their flying counterparts. More than 12 countries are at work on undersea robots right now.
Oh, my including gosh.
Including the U.S.
So remember, like, in the Matrix, like, the robots actually ruled us. Remember
yes.
those things that would fly around? I mean, it's really going to turn into that.
Well, what it's saying here is it says, now, get this. Dig the propaganda. The U.S. is using it to check for mines, map. It can be used to check for mines, map the seafloor, and collect weather data. Whatever. Says there's no reason they couldn't be used to defend battleships or small boats or even carry out attacks on enemy divers. But what will they look like? Well, apparently there's a team of researchers in Singapore. And Zixin Yu recently debuted a robotic eel design prototype. This is the man that led this whole thing. Now, there's different outfits have been using sea drones, they say, since 1957, when they first started using these. But when researchers at the University of Washington's Applied Physics Labs first launched a machine called the Special Purpose Underwater Research Vehicle. Now, the Soviet Union, of course, they conducted it, you know, and it's gone back and forth. Everybody really has. The U.S., though, started in 2013. Deputy Defense Secretary Robert Work actually gave out a little bit of a talk about it. And he lamented that the high cost to staff, maintenance, and replacing manned submarines was what was leading more and more down the
towards
the road
the use of drones. It doesn't make sense. I mean, there's going to be a day where you don't even need men on a submarine, will you? You can have a drone the size of a submarine that can park itself off
and
the coast
launch
with
other
nuclear
drones.
Missiles. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I wonder how these eels they're describing. I wonder how big they are.
Well, it doesn't really say in the article the exact size of what they are, but it can be made for anything. Here's what one of the things that it actually does talk about is he said it represents a breakthrough of robotic fish that allow effectively mimic that they effectively mimic the rather unique way an eel swims compared to other anguilliform fish. And it also says that the way it's flexible and maneuverable, it actually uses less energy than some of the older forms that they had first gone with. And now, of course, DARPA is actually explored designs
of
actual sea life. They first tried out robotic jellyfish, manta rays, tunas, and eels for years, but they've gone back
to
this.
So does the thing propel itself by swimming like a snake would, or does it have like a propeller?
Undulation.
So it really does. Man,
yeah.
That is bizarre. I could imagine an army of these things going after a ship, and each one of them is equipped with giant plasma cutters. They just cut holes in the hull and bore themselves in, and the ship sinks because it's got 1,000 holes in it all of a sudden. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, now they're calling them eel bots is what they're calling them. But yeah, you're exactly right. That's kind of what some of this actually, what they're saying is their ideas is they're going to have all kinds of sensing equipment on them and cameras, everything on there, so they can, you know, slip up on something, attach itself to a ship. Imagine listening devices that listen through the hull of the ship. You can release them. They attach, like you said, they can cut holes. Let's say they're explosive. They swim up. How do you defend against something? Let's just throw it out there and say they're 2 foot long, 24 inches, in the sea, on a battleship. How do you defend against something that's hundreds of them? And you never know when they're going to pop up. They're just trailing along in the wake of the ship and then, pink, attaching itself. And then it can explode, like you said. It can go up, get into the motors, get into anything, and attach its listening devices. EMPs is what it's designed to have its own.
Right, I mean, like I imagine a drone eel attaches itself to the bottom of the hull.
Mm-hmm.
It drills a small hole into the hull, or using a plasma cutter or something. Then it releases cockroach drones, which go all throughout the ship, which then in turn release rice drones. Mm-hmm. And like you said, you could infiltrate a whole ship You could be like tapping or bugging, wiretapping, you know, an entire ship. I mean, that stuff's coming. Several generations from now, kids are not going to understand that back in the day, we didn't have robots. So they're going to be like, well, so how did you like shovel snow out of the driveway? You got outside with the shovel. They'd be like, what? That's ridiculous.
Same as cell phones. The kids today don't understand what it was like not to have a cell phone.
I know.
You just had to call somebody at their house. Well, it's funny that you and I are bringing up all the different things, that the features that you could adapt to it, because that's a main part that he talks about.
Oh, really?
Is the adaptability. And also, remember we talked about the snake where they had worked with the timber snake. The sidewinder.
Yes.
Well, that's what they say in the same article, is the same undulating movement that propels it through the water can move it on the land. And now NASA's considering snake bots for future Mars missions.
Right.
And why tomorrow's amphibious assault weapons may not swim, walk, or roll, but also slither.
That is insane.
So we're just taking more and more steps that direction. But just like that, imagine you send them out with all those sensors. You drop them off on Mars or wherever you want to send it to. You should just like, okay, you go out and you need to do some exploring in a jungle. You drop about 2,000 of these things out there and they start crawling and mapping and talking to each other. And then you get a whole entire idea of what the landscape looks like.
You know, I don't know who wrote the Terminator movies, but you know, I know one of the titles of one of them was The Rise of the Machines. I mean, it really is the infancy of The Rise of the Machines. It seems like that's the way it's headed.
That's where
and
we're
I don't
headed.
See how there's too much out there. I mean, just since we started this show, we've reported on probably 100 different DARPA things. I mean, almost every episode we talk, we have a DARPA segment. Yeah. We haven't had it officially named, but we should. This is the DARPA segment of the week.
Yeah, we need to do that.
Because it is. I mean, it's crazy. Is this really just fear porn, though? Is it really not going to be as bad? Or am I overestimating because I've seen too many sci-fi movies and it's not really, I guess, as technically advanced as they're pretending it is? It's just more of an idea. Like, that's my problem. Sometimes they talk about this is what it's going to do, and then you get a picture in your mind, and then you look at the picture and you're like, oh, man, that looks like a box of matches with like some legs on it. Yeah. I was expecting, you know what I mean?
I'm sure to an extent, yes. It's us getting worked up over something and laughing because we think it's cool. In the back of my mind, I think it's awesome. But also, too, there's not a reason.
In my mind, I'm terrified.
Well, it's a cool idea to think of these things, but I believe that it's going to bring it to it. It's you're going to get to that point. You're going to get to where, like you said, it looks like a box of matches with legs. To one point, it looks exactly like maybe a cockroach where it can pass. For an exact cockroach, or it can pass, or like they've already talked about where they can already chip these little insects anyway.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and I've done segments where we've talked about where they've driven them. They can actually drive the cockroach where they want him to go just with the electrical stimuli. So, is it coming? Yeah, I believe it is. It's not always going to be bad. It'll be like iRobot, but also, too, could it be bad? It could be very, very, very bad.
I don't want to think about it. I don't want to talk about it.
Yeah. Hopefully, I'm dead and gone by then.
Yes. I'll make sure if I'm dead and gone. Did you see this, that Google has been reporting that there's been an enormous amount of Ouija board selling? It's one of the hottest items this Christmas.
Really?
Well, and there's an article in
Ouija boards. Yes, okay. Ouija boards. I wonder if it's because of the movie and all that stuff.
That's what they're saying. I wasn't even aware of the movie, but apparently there's a new movie that just came out about it, mm-hmm. and that has spurred a lot of people buying it. Now, there's a new article in the Independent IE, which is an Irish website, and it's called Exorcists Warn Against Buying Ouija Boards as Gifts. Get this, Cam. Exorcists and paranormal investigators are urging people, please do not buy the occult board game Ouija as a gift unless they want to invite demonic forces into their homes this Christmas.
Well, at least they're giving a warning.
Right?
Heads up, y'all.
Now, like I said, Google predicted that the modern version of the Victoria-era spirit boards will be sold out this Christmas. I mean, they're selling like hotcakes. The search engine company has confirmed the game purportedly used to contact the dead through spelled out messages is one of the top trending gifts this Christmas. And they think it's because of the new release of that movie Ouija, like we talked about.
This isn't cool.
While critics largely pan the film as cliche and horror-free, a Catholic priest based in Dublin who specializes in the occult warned that messing around with the real thing can be horrifying. And he says, it's easy to open up evil spirits, but it's very hard to get rid of them. Now, he says, people, especially young people and teenagers, who are likely to experiment with Ouija boards on a whim, can be very naive in thinking that they are only contacting the departed souls of loved ones. When they attempt to communicate with the dead using these boards, they might be talking to something else. It's like going to some parts of Africa and saying, I'm personally immune to Ebola, but it does leave people open to all kinds of spiritual dangers. People don't intend any spiritual harm by it, but we live in a spiritual realm, and you have no way to control what you may infringe upon.
That's 100%.
Right? Now, the exorcist said that evil spirits, even demons, will masquerade as departed loved ones. And they'll strike up a conversation with you. And what you don't realize is people can get infected with these demons. So the demons will play with, they'll play on your emotions. Oh, I'm your grandma.
Yeah.
And they'll tell you stuff. And you're like, oh, every weekend on Saturday night, we contact grandma. We talk to her. And then slowly that demon gets a hold of you. Right? Now, Darren Ansel, one of the three members of a team of paranormal investigators based in the North known as the Paranormal Study and Investigation Group, said he personally wouldn't touch a Ouija board with a barge pole. He said, I've had too many scares over the years. Now, Ansel's team, which was featured on the BBC's Greatest Haunts, employs scientific methods and state-of-the-art technology to determine the natural and the nature of paranormal causes, like what causes them and stuff that, like that. Now, some of PSI's controlled experiments on groups using Ouija boards confirmed subconscious muscular movement responsible for answering questions put to the board. But he also has interviewed many board users, all of whom have reported very negative experiences during or after the sessions. They include hearing demonic voices, unexplained feelings of anxiety and depression in otherwise mentally healthy people. They've even reported relationship breakdowns, noises, and seeing objects flung around or even moved. Now, he goes on to say, I've even witnessed tables walking down the hall on their own with just the fingertips touching them. Now, that is spooky.
Yeah, that's creepy.
And there's something like crazy. Now, as a little preview on the next Elite show, I'm going to talk about Zozo, the Ouija board demon.
Oh, great.
Are you familiar with him?
No, and I don't want to be familiar with him.
Well, if you want to learn more, folks, you got to sign up.
That's right.
Anyways, moving on with this episode, we're speaking with two authors about their new book, Demon Street. Now, David Roundtree and Robbie Lunt, they're going to be joining us in just a few minutes after the break. Robbie Lunt is an archaeologist, and if you don't know what an archaeologist is, it's the study of the esoteric, the metaphysical, secret, the hidden, magic, things like that, who has been performing energy work in both Tai Chi and Reiki for more than 20 years. Now, he's a member of the Way of Nature Fellowship, and when he's not doing research or haunting a theater, you may find him kayaking or skiing in the Sierra Nevadas.
Yeah.
And he lives with his wife in Nevada.
Yeah. Well, and I'm going to be discussing Mr. David Roundtree. David, man, he's done a lot. I mean, he's been involved with the paranormal a lot, lot longer. I guess you could say not a lot longer, but more in the eye of everybody. I mean, he was on, Destination America's Ghost Stalkers?
Yep.
He was actually involved on one of their episodes, and they had talked to him a bunch about that. I know he received his master's in electronical engineering and digital signal processing in like 07. But in 1978, he was certified as an audio engineer and in 85 as an acoustic engineer. So, I mean, you're talking about somebody that's like scientifically thinking also. And he's also founded the Scientific Paranormal Investigative Research Information and Technology, which is a research organization dedicated to the search for the cause of paranormal phenomena. He's also big into EVPs. He's also affiliated with the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers. He's been invited to join the Mathematics Association of America. I mean, this guy is really, really into all the scientific sides of the whole thing. And he's also studied Lakota shamanism.
Yes, that's right.
So, I mean, it's almost like you get both sides of the coin that got him involved in this whole thing. But anyway, enough with that. The book was great. The interview was great. These guys are going to get into it. This is one of those things that's like you just brought up talking about the Ouija board. It's almost like you find out in the story some that somebody opened the can and didn't put their toys back up. Didn't put the toys back in the box when they got done.
That's right.
Is basically what it was. And these guys had to deal with it. Now, the story all took place in 1985. And then we discussed a bunch of things on there. But the name of the book is Demon Street, the true story of a very haunted house.
Stick with us, folks. We're going to get into that interview after the break. This is Expanded Perspectives. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we've got a real treat for you tonight, a real spine-tingling true story. We're going to get into it here with some famous ghost hunters, David Roundtree and Robert Lunt. And they're going to tell us about their new book, Demon Street, a true story of a very haunted house where they intervened and helped out a woman in Gainesville, Florida, when her house became, or the place she was living, became inundated with, you know, phantom spirits and dancing stoves and a demonic force.
Pretty much everything and all things evil and bad.
That's right. David and Robbie, how are you doing out there?
Oh, we're doing pretty good. How are you guys doing?
We're doing great.
We're getting by.
It's all here. We're all getting by.
Well, this new book, I have to say, it's a really cool story. And if people are into ghost hunting and, you know, stories where people have to delve into this spirit world and fight with these demons, you always see the movies with exorcisms and crazy things like that. I really enjoyed this book because most books on paranormal things start out as like a scary ghost story. But this really kind of ends up being about a spiritual transformation. That's mm-hmm. what I think I took from the book. And, you know, like most books start out, whether you go to this haunted house, they assemble a ghost hunting team together, they do an investigation, they bring a priest. Your book goes way beyond that and really details what it's like and what you need to do when you find yourself in a situation when you have to deal with this, with these things, these entities. Can you tell us how you started out with this friend of yours, Penny? And this took place in Gainesville, right?
Yeah, I'm going to let Robbie take the lead because she actually came to him with her problem. So Robbie sort of did the setup on this.
Okay.
Yeah, it was very, very interesting. We were actually in White Springs. They have a folk festival there every year. A lot of good bluegrass and that kind of thing. But we had some time to kill. And she started talking to me and she started telling me about how haunted her house was. When she realized that I wasn't blowing her off and I was actually kind of interested, she started telling me about this big black eye that would appear in her field of vision every night when she fell asleep. She then gets sucked out of her body, and this old man with a beard would take her around the property she was living on. There were three houses there, and it would take her around this property, and it would show her all the different spirits that were inhabiting the houses around her property. And then, well, we had to get back to work, and that was in, I believe, in June. And I kind of forgot about it. Right. I didn't see her again. I told Dave a little bit about it, and we thought it was kind of neat. But then on Labor Day weekend of that same year, and this was in 1985, on Labor Day weekend, it was a Friday night, I went to see a friend, and Penny was there. And the physical transformation in her was just, it was devastating. She had the deep black circles under her eyes. Her hair was flashed out to the side. She really did look like Grandmama from the Addams Family. But then she started to tell me that everything had gotten worse in her house. Her husband had gone on a film shoot, and the spirit seemed to know that. And so they took advantage of her helpless situation, and it had gotten too much for her. So she went to her neighbor's house, and while she was trying to spend the night there, the stove in the middle of the night started to dance in the kitchen. And it followed it up with a wave that went through a hardwood floor that picked her up and slammed her to the ground and then hit the wall and bounced back and did the same thing again. And when I saw her that evening, she had run out screaming the night before and hadn't been back since. So that was really, at that point, I said, I think I know somebody who can help us out. We'd love to come and see what's going on there. She gave me her address and guaranteed me that she would not be back there that weekend. So that was really the introduction to it. And at that point, of course, I called Dave and said, well, I've got a house that has a dancing stove and there's all kinds of ghosts. And I figured, what the heck? Let's go over there, you know? How often do you get to go to a house that's that haunted,
right,
that there's a chance you might see something happening? So the reality of it was a lark. We went as kind of like let's go see what's going to happen, and had no intention of having it profoundly affect our lives the way it did.
Well, Robbie, I guess the first thing I wanted to ask you, even after you made that statement, was, had you and her and Penny, had y'all discussed anything like that? Or what do you think made her feel like she could talk to you about it out of everybody that you work with and bump into? And I'm sure she's got other friends and stuff. I mean, what made it feel like, or do you even know? I mean, had y'all discussed anything? Or did she just feel like, hey, I think I could talk to Robbie about this?
And, you know, it's a kind of a weird thing. I think you get put into positions like this. I always have. People have come up and tell me the most amazing things that I don't think they would tell their brother or their mother. But they'll come out and just lay it out to me out of the blue. I guess I put off that kind of vibe. And again, once she started to tell me the story, I didn't blow her off. I didn't even roll my eyes. I actually was very interested. I've always been very interested in the paranormal. So I think that people can sense that openness from other people, and she caught it that it was there.
I completely agree, because that's the way we always talk about how if there's a light, there's always a dark. So maybe if the dark side, what they were doing, whatever the good side was, decided to take you guys, and y'all were their chess pieces. They're like, all right, we're going to move these guys into position now to go up against this. Because what I gathered was from reading the book is a lot of people I know in other interviews and things, and even other listeners have talked about, some people have missed the point of the book, is it's not like y'all were seasoned investigators to all this and had done this hundreds of times. This was kind of one of those things that you walked in and was like, I got to sink or swim. This is trial by fire. All of a sudden you got roped into it.
Yeah, I would say that's probably a pretty decent and accurate assessment of the situation. You have to remember, too, this was 1985. There were no ghost hunting shows on TV. There were no people didn't talk about this.
EVP businesses selling all kinds of ghost equipment. Yeah, and stuff. That didn't exist. I
mean, nobody knew what an EVP was.
Yeah, you had a Polaroid, right?
Yeah, well,
with the, like, six cubes. And then once the six pictures were taken, you had to throw it away?
Actually, we searched for something called a rod of a voice because we didn't know what EVP was. And we were using big old antiquated TIAC reel-to-reels that weighed about 70 pounds apiece. And, you know, it just was a different sort of environment back then.
Back in the day.
Yeah. And you didn't talk about it. You talked about it in a very small circle of friends. And you had to make sure that those friends, like, you know, weren't going to take you as a crazy person and that sort of thing. Because back in Florida in those days, you had this thing called the Baker Act, which allowed anyone to, like, put you in under psychiatric observation for 24 to 48 hours for no particular reason. So you had to be very careful.
I believe so.
Talked about. But, yeah, we literally went over there kind of like for fun. And that all changed when we set foot on the property.
Well, and that's another thing, too, is that I remember reading, and y'all have discussed that you could both, not just like one of you had an uneasy feeling, both of you felt an uneasiness, like a heaviness of the whole area when you got there.
Yeah, it was an oppressive feeling, very oppressive. I had never encountered anything like that in my life. I mean, you know, one of the common questions we get asked was, when did you know it was haunted? It's like we knew something was amiss and it wasn't just a haunting when we set foot on the property. Once we did, it was like we entered into Alice's rabbit hole. I mean, it was like the whole place was on acid or something, you know? I mean, it was just literally off the wall, off the charts. So we didn't go there with a lot of equipment or anything else. First of all, there wasn't a lot of equipment back then. And second of all, back in those days, most of these types of encounters were a very subjective nature. I mean, even Hans Holzer, he used to investigate ghosts using a medium. So we went in as a subjective experience to feel and to see and to, you know, try to experience it and to get our take on it in a very non-scientifical and non-technical manner. And boy, did we have a great time doing that.
Yeah, well, and so, and you kind of had a similar, I mean, not a similar, but you had a background, right, David, in shamanism or something? So you were somewhat familiar with, what's the word I'm looking for, like elemental spirits?
Yeah, the spirituality of the whole situation was not wasted on me.
Right, nature spirits, I guess that was the word I was looking for.
That, and I had never, of course, encountered anything like this before. So this was a first time for me, and of course, you know, there wasn't any book for it. So, you know, I was like, oh, boy, well, here we go. What's going to happen to us? Make sure our life insurance is paid off, you know.
Well, it seems to have made a really good friendship bond between the two of you also, as it's kind of like going to battle together.
Yeah, it is. I mean, that definitely made us tighter. We were pretty tight to begin with because we'd spent a lot of time with each other working long days doing, you know, concerts, you know, plays, theatrical productions from a technical point of view. So, you know, when you do something like that, you're part of a big family anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Robbie was like my right-hand person at the University of Florida doing performing arts series, and we did shows and concerts on campus. So he was like my right-hand person. So we were very, very tight to start with. But this definitely made us tighter in a different way. I mean, more of a spiritual way, I think.
Now, when you guys went there the first time, let me get this right. There was three houses on the property, right? There was the one where Penny was living. There was another one that was occupied by the landlord, a man by the name of Clevis. And then there was another one that was like a workshop with a... like a guest apartment above the workshop, and that's where most of the problems were. Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely. It was you had the two apartment type things that had rooms or workshops underneath them, and then the house that Clevis lived in was actually a pretty much a standard bungalow, you know, a 3-bedroom place, relatively small, clapboard sides, tin roof. But there were three full residences on the property.
Okay, and so the first time you guys went, and I'm sure Penny was aware that you and David clearly knew something was going on. Did you and David have like a meeting and say, "Look, we got to come back here. We got to try to figure out what's going on and how we can cleanse this area of these spirits"?
Well, you know, it was a lot weirder than that. We got the address from Penny, and we were just going to go by and check it out. We actually didn't expect to really do anything more than go and look in a couple windows. And when we pulled up, she was pulling in the driveway as we pulled in, and I was kind of surprised, and I asked her what was up, and she looked at us and said, "Well, they said you were coming over right now, so I figured it'd be a good time to get in and get some things while there was somebody here."
So she needed just a little backup.
But the fact is somebody told her we were on our way over.
Yeah, someone like not.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, they said y'all were on your way over. You're like, "Wait, what? No, we didn't tell anybody we were coming. We just decided we were coming."
And yeah. That was the other interesting thing. Clevis was gone for the full weekend. I mean, he was not going to be back. We figured he wouldn't be back till Tuesday or Wednesday. And a little bit after we had come back after our first experience with the place, we get a phone call, and I'll be darned if Clevis wasn't cutting his vacation short and he was going to be back that evening.
So it was like he almost had like an otherworldly... I guess you could say like a safety system set up there to alert him to things.
Oh, absolutely.
Almost, yeah, kind of like a... I can't... It's almost... He was such the character. I mean, even like I told you off air, that was the guy that drew me into this whole thing. Was there is so much that it seems like it stems from him. It all revolves around him. He is the cancer at the center of this whole problem.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Dave, I agree.
Yeah, he was definitely the catalyst. I mean, there's no doubt about Clevis having his own personal agenda in all this. And the thing is that what you don't see in this book, but what you'll see in the next book or the sequel to this book, is we learned so many things after the fact that we didn't know back then. That sort of makes everything fall into perspective. So the next book is kind of going to be about throwing it all into perspective with then and tying it into things that are happening now. So it's the next book is a segue, really, because we have at least four more books that we're going to write in this series about this whole encounter and how it continued to plague us over a period of about 27 years. And still does to this day.
Oh, yeah. Well, we discussed that too, as we had a little issues trying to get everything up and going. It's kind of like it's lingering over. It's bleeding over into what we were working with.
Yeah, it's kind of like a bad case of gas, man.
It's just lingering.
Yes.
Well, and you know, after reading the book, I had listened and some of the other interviews you had done and read some of the other things. And what you were talking about him is the history of basically his, maybe the you know, the, his question of how he was, I guess you could say, fathered and how he was raised and some of the history of, like you discuss in the book, about the books that he had. The things that he had, it's almost...
Yeah, right, really old books.
Well, it's almost Aleister Crowley-esque in the way of the things that he might have performed and done out there and just kind of laid low and no telling really what he was trying to get at.
Oh, and not just him, his grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows how many generations it went back. So, you know, it was just, I don't know, it was a... Like I say, I've never encountered anything like that.
I tell you, the truth of the matter is I think, I really do, I think he was trying to get his grandfather back. And in doing that, he just took that final step. That or his grandfather had some kind of attachment to something or owed some spirit some kind of tithing so that when Clevis thought he was getting his grandfather, he might have gotten his grandfather, but something a lot nastier came along for the ride.
Yeah, that's what it seems like. And you even discussed in there about how sometimes angry, like nature spirits can be pleased, or even ghosts. Lots of times they'll move on once they've been, you people have listened to what they want to be told, or once someone points them towards the light. But demons, their thirst is insatiable. And so they always, if you conjure something up, which it sounds like that's what Clevis had done in an attempt to get his grandfather, like you were saying, but it spilled over. I mean, even his girlfriend seemed to be possessed by something. It didn't even seem to bother Clevis. He was like, oh, yeah, they do that all the time to her.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. And you know, there's something very important that you touch base on here. You know, demons just don't waltz into our reality, you know, at will. They have to be invited. They have to be conjured. They have to be brought into this reality. So when you encounter something like that, you're not encountering a demon happenstance. You're encountering also a human that brought it there. And there's always that relationship somewhere. They may have died and passed on, or they may have left the area, but their handiwork remains behind. And a lot of the secret of getting rid of that or turning it and sending it back where it came from is understanding how it was brought in the first place.
Yeah, and it sounds like that's exactly... I mean, Clevis posed a question directly to you, right? Bragging about his abilities.
To Robbie, yeah.
Yeah, after we had gone back to the property for a second time, and quite frankly, I don't even know why we were still standing there and I wasn't running down the road screaming.
Yeah, right?
You know, he came up to me at... I swear that he knew where he was. Just to this day, I can see this so clearly. But he stepped up to me and he put one hand up. And you know the old Bela Lugosi films where you get just a strip of light?
Yes. Yes.
That's what his face looked like.
Just right across his eyes, just where it really accents the way he's glaring at you.
Exactly.
And then he grabbed my hand and he said, I can conjure demons, can you? And, of course, my response was, well, I really don't want to.
Yeah. Yeah, right? I mean, an odd question.
He looked back at me and said, but that's not what I asked you. I asked you if you can conjure demons. I can. And at that point, I felt this energy just surging up his arm and into my arm, and it got real bizarre after that.
I just picture a guy with like greasy fingernails and kind of stringy hair and tobacco stained teeth glaring at me. It's a completely unnerving. The whole thing is unnerving, especially like y'all talked about. This is the first time you go there, just kind of like, let's go take a look, see what it is. It's almost like you felt like you walked into a movie. You're sitting there, you're like, this is a joke. Are you people pulling my leg?
I kept looking for Porch Boy.
It's right.
You know, I mean, it was that kind of bizarre.
I just can't be real.
But, you know, at the time, I lived in a haunted house. I had things happening quite frequently in the house I was actually living in. So there was that little bit of a buffer. I had that little bit. You know, Dave had his training. I had that little bit of a buffer. But once you started dealing with what this was, it was something completely different. You definitely switched realities.
Yeah, and I mean, I love the details you were giving about how it looked like the walls were breathing. Yeah. You could see them moving.
A window's opening and closing.
Right? Yeah, absolutely.
You even saw like a green aura even around the whole house, right?
Yeah, the whole upstairs of that house behind Cleavis's house, it was an abandoned house with all the furniture and everything, just like somebody had just left it. And, you know, like abandoned it in the middle of the night, which we found out later they, in fact, had. but the whole inside of it glowed this greenish, almost like a day glow greenish, monster green kind of color, like a fog almost. And it was just very surreal. I mean, that's the only thing that I can, I can't even explain it. It was so weird. But the closest thing I can get to it is kind of like that day glow greenish fog, like you hear people associate with like the Devil's Triangle and things like that. It's like I now know what they saw because I saw it in that house.
Well, what you had alluded to at the beginning of the interview was you were talking about like it was almost like LSD and Alice in Wonderland because you had talked about the grin on his girlfriend's face.
I've never seen a human being have a grin go from ear to ear.
And it was almost like it was a permanent fixture for a while. It wasn't like she just did it in just one time. She's sitting there glaring with that grin on her face.
It was a contortion. It definitely was. I mean, and that was probably the creepiest part of the whole night for me was looking at that vacant stare and the grin that went with it.
Man.
Well, and it's not like it when you left there that it left you alone. It's like once you all noticed it, then it decided to start hanging out. Because, Robbie, didn't you have something happen on a catwalk?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I always kind of explain it that it got our scent.
Yeah.
This was, I think there's two different kinds of demonic encounters when they do occur. And like Dave says, it's so extraordinarily rare. But you have some instances where there's possessions, where whatever it is, it's attached to a specific person and all the issues surround that. But then I think you have some that are free-ranging, and we were lucky enough to get a free-range demon. And it's funny, the thing that happened on the catwalk, I'd never really considered the ramifications of it until we started writing the book. And when I was reliving that, it occurred to me at that point, and I got pissed off. It was like, that damn thing tried to kill me.
Mm-hmm.
And to be quite honest with you, we were so wrapped up in what was happening and trying to keep an even keel that at that point in time, it really didn't occur to me that it had actually tried to kill me.
It was coming after you.
Yes, absolutely. Unfortunately, we had a poor innocent friend of ours was there. And, you know, that slight encounter, he felt it go through him. And it had it totally changed his life. When your views of reality are shattered and you're concrete in your way of thinking, it can be very devastating. At least for me, I wasn't so concrete in my way of thinking, and those little bits that were shattering my reality, I was able to take in. But our friend really took it quite horribly.
Yeah, I'm still trying to figure out how you went through Cleavis and I that night in the bedroom when you opened the closet door. I still have no explanation for how you ended up behind us.
Started out in front and ended up behind.
It was literally like he walked through us.
Well, and you explained missing time, too. Didn't you guys miss like 4 or 5 hours?
Oh, yeah, that was a regular occurring event. You know, to so many people, it would have disoriented them so bad that they, you know, probably would have gone insane. For us, however, it was amazing how calm we stayed and just took everything in stride like it was normal and joked about it. Because if we hadn't have done that, if we hadn't have made light of it and joked about it, we probably would have come apart at the seams. But we were constantly joking about how funny this demon was. And it was really quite terrifying the whole time.
The only way to deal with it, yeah, really, kind of.
You know, we would laugh about it because that would cut the tension. It would cut the stress that we were going through. And we were laughing at ourselves more than anything else.
Do you think that the demon sensed that you were laughing at it? You know what I mean? Like, I wonder if that angered it more and that's why.
Well, yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Could it perceive that? Because most of the time, that's exactly what you were talking about. It wants to instill fear in people, and it kind of feeds off that. Like me, I would be terrible to have along with you because I'd be scared to death. I would have ran, you know.
I would have done the investigation with a roll of toilet paper and a nice pair of track shoes.
Nice,
that's how I'd have done it.
And a nice pick for the itchy spots.
Yeah, I'd have been gone.
That's the thing. You know, these things feed on negativity. They feed off your fear. They feed off of your weakness. And then when you laugh and lark it off, like, you know, there's nothing to it, that intensifies their fury as well. Of course, we didn't realize that or even care at the time. We were trying to survive. But that's definitely true. And I do believe that it sensed everything we did because it showed up all over Gainesville when we were doing something. I mean, there would be something that would let us know it was there.
Yeah. And see, that's people always email the show asking if I would be interested in going on some ghost hunts with them and stuff. And I always turn them down. It's for that very reason. I don't want anything to follow me home.
Yeah.
I would be scared that it could latch on and I could bring it home and then, you know, that would be the end of it.
And, you know, that's one of the reasons why we wrote the book.
Right.
The book is definitely a warning. You know, all these people are out there messing with this stuff, and it will follow you home, and it will screw with your life if you're not careful.
Well, that's what I was going to move on to next. I was going to ask you two, for any of the listeners at home who are interested in this stuff, do you have to have any paranormal powers to deal with hauntings?
That's a good question. I think it certainly doesn't hurt. And I think in our case, if we hadn't have had some experience, some training in dealing with this stuff in general, it could have been a totally different outcome.
Right.
So I would say, you know, the working title of this book is Careful What You Wish For. There's a lot of truth in that.
Yes.
You may find something that you didn't bargain for. And if you're not prepared to deal with that, you're in a world of hurt.
Is there any advice that you would give to someone who thinks that their home might have a demon in it?
Yeah, if they got problems going on or they're kind of experiencing something like this, what would y'all tell them?
Robbie?
You know, the very first thing I tell you is go to your local clergy. What's your faith? Always go with your faith because for you, that's where the first layer of power lies, you know. Then there's the very easy ones. There's the smudging of the house with sage. But, you know, the thing about it is just because you're having an encounter that seems negative to you does not mean it's demonic or anything. You know, if somebody was a butthead in life, they're going to be a butthead in death, and you've just got a gnarly ghost.
We've had several people tell us that same thing that we've had on.
You know, and nature spirits, they may be absolutely, completely not even caring about you, but you were in your way, you were in their way, and they have their own agenda. They're totally neutral, yet because of your perception of their actions, you may see it as negative. So, you know, you got to be real careful about how it's perceived, because not everything you're dealing with is actually a demon or a negative thing. It may be just something that you're in its way.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I know Dave's run into that a few times too.
Oh yeah, I mean, if you get between a nature spirit and that nature spirit's agenda, you're going to think that the halls of hell opened up and is trying to swallow you because you're in the way. But it really has no desire or design on you. You're just standing in the path. You know, it's just better to step aside and let it do its thing, man, than to stand there and try to take it on.
Well, and listening to you guys, I mean, knowing that, like Robbie said, everyone seems to kind of open up to him, and then also knowing that David's past is in shamanism, both of you were kind of prepared, or at least maybe even without knowing you were this prepared, your whole lives for something like this. And I kind of always kind of equate it to something like scuba diving. You start out learning in a pool, and you work your way up till you get your open water license in the ocean. Is the way it gets there a bigger subject to really attack. So it's almost like if somebody's having this problem, I like that you said, go to the clergy, go to somebody that you spiritually can kind of get in touch with. Don't just kind of go, I've never run a marathon before and I'm going to sign up for the Boston Marathon.
Exactly. And the thing is, too, is the book uses the demonic situation as a vehicle. Like you said, in your perception of your reading of the book's really about a personal spiritual journey. It's really about Robbie's development on his own spiritual path and how that event sort of coalesced into that, you know, to drive him into that existence, you know, that spiritual existence. I was just a catalyst that sort of put things on the table for him to work with. But the funny thing about it is Robbie had approached me a couple of times talking about the subject of being a medicine man or you know, being, you know, based on a shamanic type of life. And, you know, the spirits have to really point a person out to you. I like to say power points out your apprentices, because you can go and be talking to someone. They can be a medicine man or a shaman or whatever. And if power doesn't tell that person to pick you, to teach you, you're going to play stupid and not say anything. And this particular case pointed Robbie out to me that he needed to know things in order to survive. And that's how he sort of really grabbed the bull by the horns and started his own personal journey.
Well, it's incredible. And I really enjoyed the book. If I have another question, it's this. You said that this happened back in 1985. I just want to know why in 2014 you guys decided to write the book finally, now after all that time.
Go ahead, Bobby.
You know, the bottom line truth is we would not have been able to deal with the ramifications of writing the book until now. When it first happened, like Dave said, that we would have been locked up as wackos. And I think on personal spiritual journeys for both Dave and myself, we needed to be where we were before we really stirred the pot. As y'all found out, there's things out there that would prefer you not to have hope. And I think our book, to a certain extent, gives people that are in really bad situations hope, and kind of makes other people aware of, hey, maybe this stuff really is out there. So there's a lot of energies that don't want it out. But on the other hand, I've been telling this story since then, and quite honestly, every one of those vignettes is just so burned into my consciousness that it had to get out eventually.
Yeah, and it probably is more accepted now than in 1985. I mean, there's tons of shows on TV now just showing ghost hunting and things like that. So I can imagine now it would be easier. Now, since 1985, have you guys continued to do ghost hauntings and investigations, or have you just only really had that one experience?
Dave has a world. Let me start, because mine is not quite as exciting as where he has ended up. I continued on the shamanic path.
Okay.
And in that time, quite honestly, I've had two more demonic encounters. I'm very lucky. I work in a field where I can tell ghost stories, I can hear ghost stories, and I can experience ghosts, and everybody goes, oh, you got to see it. I mean, I work in the theater. I work in the entertainment business. Every theater you go into, there is some kind of haunting. So I'm lucky. I've been able to continue that. I don't ghost hunt or ghost do the research per se, because quite frankly, if I walk into a place and it's haunted, I immediately know.
Yeah, you've kind of had that experience, so now you know what to look for.
You're in tune. You're in tune with it.
Exactly. But do I ask the stories? Absolutely. Every theater I go into, I collect ghost stories, and I collect ghost stories from all the people that travel. And then, you know, like I said, Dave has become the scientific authority on ghost stories. So, Dave, please.
Yeah, well, after that event, I sort of turned my back on my shamanic path for literally 27 years and dove completely headfirst into the scientific research and search for answers in science to quantify some of the things that not only we experienced, but the whole haunting phenomena in general. And it ended up, I wrote a book called Paranormal Technology, Understanding the Science of Ghost Hunting. I started a research laboratory. I was recently on a TV show called Ghost Stalkers, which I did the scientific experimentations that went on during the show. And I'm pretty much nationally known as a scientific authority on the research of paranormal phenomena I sort of became the people that I idolized in my youth, which is kind of an interesting story. But last October, I was reborn again as a shaman, and from a different perspective than my original stance on it. I had a different power animal, but it completely, it was a rapid growth. It came so fast that I couldn't process it quick enough. And it's just now finally all falling into place again. So, yeah, I mean, I almost made it into a career, and Robbie made it into a way of life.
Okay, well, go ahead, Cam.
Man, I'm just, well, that's another thing I want to ask is you're Lakota, correct?
No, my teacher was a Lakota.
He was Lakota.
Yeah, he was Lakota. The line of medicine I originally learned was a Lakota line of medicine. And when I say a line, it's they will tell you who taught them, who taught their teacher, who taught their teacher's teacher. It's a line of medicine, they call it. And I actually, my first teacher was a Lakota medicine man, and he taught me what he knew. But, you know, you continue to learn. You don't just learn from one person. You get things, and then you go off on your own, and you become like a solitary practitioner, because I wasn't affiliated with any particular tribe. But then you run into people on your path that teach you things. And I have a teacher now that's a Powhatan, which is what my native heritage is. And he's a sun dancer. And he's quite an incredible individual. He's taught me a lot of things about my own people that were lost over the years. So you're never too old to have a teacher. And in fact, generally speaking, you constantly have one coming and going in your life.
Well, do you feel like at a young age you were drawn to that before you ever got into into learning it?
Oh, yeah. My grandfather, who was, you know, full-blooded Native American, he appeared to me the night that he died in my room, and that's really what started me on the whole journey, was trying to figure out what happened that night. I was 7 years old, and he came in and said, you know, I love you, but I have to go. And I told my mom the next morning, she said, your grandfather died last night, and that was my introduction to the paranormal.
Did you just look her in the eye and say, I know he came and talked to me?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know he had died. He looked very real. I mean, he looked physical and corporeal and just like ordinary, except that he didn't have his leg brace on and his arm wasn't paralyzed and all gnarled up and atrophied. He had had a stroke about 10 years prior to that, and it had paralyzed one side of his body. And he didn't have any signs of that, and he was walking normal. And that was a little odd, but I didn't really think too much of it at 7 years old.
You're seven.
Yeah. You know, you don't analyze something like we do as adults. And I just was happy to see my grandfather, wondering why he was there.
Well, to straighten it out for the listeners, too, when you're talking about medicine, you're not talking about actual, like, medicine practice, are you?
No, it's a type of traditional healing, but it's much more than that. I mean, a medicine man in a tribe is a psychologist, he's a counselor, he's a healer, he's a teacher, he wears a lot of different hats of the spiritual variety. But, you know, they didn't teach you how to take care of demons. So that was like something we learned by doing.
Well, I'm going to have I got another question I got to ask the both of you.
Of course.
If you had the chance, would you ever go back to that house and do another investigation?
Say no. Say no.
you know, believe it or not, I don't know about my dear friend Dave, but I know I have people swing by there, oh, at least once a year and just give a feel for me.
So it still exists. It's still standing.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's but it's the energy has, I think, morphed. And, you know, if we look at the perspective and you say, looking back, given the chance to go back into the same situation, would I do that again? First of all, I don't think on a conscious basis I had it.
I don't know what happened to Robbie.
Demons.
Let's see if we can get him back. Hold on a second.
Okay.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Oh, there he is. Okay.
He's back.
We thought they got you.
Swallowed by the wormhole.
That's right. They got Robbie. No. It's like that old movie House, when they opened the door and it pulled him in.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we lost Robbie for a few minutes, but we're back. We were talking about if you guys would ever go back to that house. and investigated again, and Robbie had been mentioning that to this day people still drive by it and talk about the sensation they get when they're there, but you don't think it's as strong as it used to be.
No, actually, what I meant is I have people drive by and check it out for us to make sure it never comes back.
I gotcha.
And as I was starting to say, you know, given the choice of if going back in time and that, would I do it again? I don't think I really had the choice to begin with, but yes, I would, because, you know, it was more than just it was a woman that really needed help. There was nobody else there that could help her, and it needed to be us. So,
yeah,
I'd step right back into it. But then I'm not considered all that sane either. So,
have y'all stayed in contact at all with Penny? I mean, even like as of recent?
No.
I think she really wanted to continue on with her life. She wanted it. It was as tough as it was for us. It was a truly horrifying experience for her. And I wouldn't be surprised if at this point, other than nightmares at night, she hasn't managed to psychologically completely shut it out of her mind.
When she was, I don't blame her one bit. It would be the thing that just, she wants to move on. And that's one of the parts you never want to go back and revisit.
Exactly. I mean, you know, when you get to where we are, where we've opened that door already, you know, there's no shutting it for us. It's just one thing after another after another. And, you know, after a while, you get used to that. But, you know, people come across your path for a reason. And she came across ours for a reason. And like Robbie said, we were really the only people that could have helped her. And we're alive, a little bent and twisted and gnarled. You know,
right. Bent, but not broken.
Exactly. So, you know, that was for a reason. It was for our growth. That was for her salvation. Well, so would we do it again? Absolutely, we would, and we do.
And another part that I was going to talk to you about earlier is it seems like you had help at all turns a little bit, like they was the white light was like it was kind of kicking in a little bit, like the story of the woman giving you the crystal and the people involved. It was like everybody was kind of doing their part, whether they really realized it or not.
Yeah, let Robbie address that because he's pretty good at explaining
the crystal story. Was awesome.
But all throughout it was amazing. In fact, even my mother-in-law, who is a scientist, she didn't believe any of this was going on, but she said, "But you know, I just happen to have contact with this gentleman down in Tampa, and he takes care of these things. So if you get into too much of a trouble, let me know, and I'll give you that name." So yeah, spirit was helping. It seemed to be one of these things they weren't able to get involved in, but they had to make sure that it happened. So we were getting clues and information and people just coming out of the blue. The psychic was amazing, handing us the crystal. And, you know, things tried to keep it from happening. The crystal opened up her finger. It drew blood because there was a constant ongoing fight. It's not all out in the open like it is in Hollywood, but it's a constant battle. It really is a struggle.
You know, her name was Ruth Davenport, and I've often wondered whatever became of that woman. She's probably long passed on because she was elderly when she helped us back in 1985, but at the time she was a registered psychic medium in the Jacksonville area, and I hope she had a great life. I mean, I never got a chance to thank her afterwards. None of us did, but she was a high point at a period when we were like, had no idea what we were going to do. And she sort of gave us direction at a very opportune moment. And I always wanted to thank her for what happened and tell her the story. And we never got a chance to do that. So that's like a regret that comes from it, because she really was a catalyst for us.
Well, and the greatest part of the story was like she was going to give you one. She's like, no, and it's like she pops the trunk and she's digging around. It's like they're going to give you a gun, but they're like, no, I got hand grenades over here. Let me go get this. And then she's digging around for explosives and like, this is what you need. This is the one to take with you.
her words were like, no, you need the big gun.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
But without even going there, she knew instantly. She was like, they're in trouble. She could probably already see what y'all were involved with. And we're like, I'm going to have to help these guys out.
she knew when we walked through the door.
And you know, it was so amazing. Yeah, it was the most amazing thing. Sorry, Dave.
Go ahead, brother.
It was the most amazing thing. We opened up that door, and when we opened up that door, there was a psychic sitting right inside the front door. He took one look at us. There were about five of us because other people went in with us. He took one look at us, and he looked at his lap, and he would not lift his head for anything. Huh. If we yelled fire, he would just sat there staring at his lap.
Yeah, everyone made a very obvious attempt to not make eye contact with us. She was the only one staring at us and grinning like a jackass and smiling, and the woman, the poor woman in front of her, was crying her eyes out, the client she had, and she was looking at us and grinning like a jackass.
I tell you, the most amazing thing, though, was every single psychic in that room, every other one except for that guy, when we walked in that door, it was like a Fosse choreography. They all spun, and they all looked at us, and they gave us the once-over, and then they went back to what they were doing.
And I could feel that energy.
Yeah, it was. We knew we were kind of. We already knew we were walking a weird path, but that one really set.
We realized we were spiritual lepers at that point.
Well, is there any place that you guys are going to be speaking soon? Is there anything coming up in the future where people could, any book signings or conferences or anything like that in the future coming up?
I actually don't have anything planned. I may be speaking in Chicago in January, and I have a couple of gigs booked for next October. But amazingly, I don't have any bookings other than that. And Robbie and I don't have any bookings together. So,
okay, well, do you have a website? I know you do, but will you tell the listeners your website so they can go on there, not only buy the book, but if they have any encounters, maybe they can get in contact with you and pass those along. It sounds like Robbie's already compiling a huge list of ghost stories from the work he does.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's for me personally, you can go to www.wordpress.arcanology101.com, and that is my blog site. I also have an author site on Facebook. And Dave?
Yeah, I have the lab site, spinvestigations.org. That's SP Investigations, all one word, .org. And it has a lot of my research and links to my other book. I also have a huge Facebook presence, and you can Google both of us and find all sorts of things on us.
Well, awesome. And there is a demonstreetusa.com as well, is there not?
Yes, there is.
And they can go on there.
Thanks for bringing that up. We always forget to say that.
Yeah, well, I'm going to put, well, on the, there'll be links to all the things you mentioned in our show notes for people to click on. And it's Christmas is coming up, folks. If you're interested in this type of thing, I strongly suggest you buy this book. It really is interesting. I loved it.
And you said this isn't the last.
That's
right.
This
is the first of four.
Yeah. We thought it was going to be a standalone book until we started writing it. But so many things happened in the process of writing it, and then the events that took place after we wrote it, and it went to the publisher, and then continued to happen, has just given us a plethora of grab bag items to basically write more books about the whole process. And in that process, we connected with other people. We started a circle. We took on a huge struggle. We're still dealing with parts of that struggle. That's really an earth-changing struggle. And that's an interesting story, too. It's a little bit different than this story, and yet it's connected.
Sounds like the genie's out of the bottle, guys.
Yeah, that's kind of a good analysis.
Well, man, you're going to have to come back on when those books come out and talk about, you know, those whenever they're released.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Without a doubt, it's been a blast.
All right, guys. Well, that's it for tonight, folks. Thanks again to David Roundtree and Robbie Lunt for coming on and sharing and talking about this book, Demon Street. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
You bet. Kyle, Cam, have a wonderful evening.
And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. I hope everybody enjoyed that interview. Cam, what did you think?
They're great guys. I mean, yet again, it's one of those things that we discussed all that stuff with them, and then we get off air, and we keep going and discussing more and more stuff. And I mean, I'm really excited because I enjoyed the book. It wasn't what I thought it was going to be at first. I thought it was going to be a typical romp,
just ghost stories or something. Yeah, that's
wasn't what I thought it was going to be. I did enjoy it. just the ideas because it kind of let me think about a lot of that stuff. And then I was excited to know that they're going to write a few more about him and talk about more of the stuff that's happened to him since all this went down. Because off air, when we discussed it, some of it wasn't so great what happened to him after they got involved in this.
Yeah.
You know, they've kind of had some ups and downs and some rough downs. So, I mean, it was one of those things. You brought it up, and then it always makes me think, and we've said it before, I'm like, I don't want to get involved in that kind of research. I like reading about it and I don't know, you know, just kind of looking into the whole thing, but I don't want to physically go to these places. I don't want to be involved in that.
No, I don't want to be involved with it at all.
I have nothing but respect for the people that put themselves in those positions. I'm just not that, like I said, I'll go to the woods and run, but I don't.
I'm a coward. I'm not afraid to admit it. I don't want to mess with ghost spirits, demons, djinn. I don't want to mess with any of that.
Yeah, I'm not down with it. So my hat's off to those fellas and everybody, all the listeners that do it. My hat's off to you folks. I'm just not going to do it, man. I don't have that. I'm good. I'm just, I'm like, y'all stay over there. I'll stay over here. Creepy dudes. No, and we're good. We're just going to stay like that.
Yeah, right. But I really did enjoy the book. And if you guys are into ghosts and hauntings and demonic possessions and things like that, then you need to pick up this book. It's a new page book, Demon Street, USA, right? And I'm going to put links to their website, the ways to get a hold of David and Robbie.
Yeah.
If you have any questions for them.
I know that it's in Barnes & Noble. It's dumped in a lot of bookstores. You can also, of course, get it online.
That's right. And if you're new to the show, don't forget you can email us any stories or encounters of your own.
Mm-hmm.
Our email is expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. You can follow us on Twitter. You can follow us on Facebook. You can find the podcast numerous places. If you can, there's apps and everything. You can take us with us. And don't forget, in addition to the show every Monday, we have an elite show, which is every Thursday, but it's a subscription-only show. So it's pretty cheap, $5 a month or $55 a year. So, I mean, man, it's pretty cheap. It's like the price of one latte.
Yeah, right?
I mean,
you get two shows a week that way.
That's right. And it's Christmas. Maybe you should get a subscription for one of your friends or family.
Or get it for yourself. Give yourself a gift.
Treat yourself, right?
Yeah, exactly. Have some fun.
Yeah.
We're having a great time. Thanks for listening. Everybody on Dark Matter Radio, thank you so much for listening and sticking it out and all of us having a good time. So we're glad you enjoyed it. And we got some few more good interviews coming up.
Yep.
We got some pretty interesting history interviews and some pretty strange stuff coming up. So everybody, have a great work week. Everybody, nose to the grindstone for a little bit longer before we get a little Christmas break action. So we'll try to struggle through it.
That's right. Stay with us. And we will talk to the elitist on Thursday. And for everybody else, we will see you and speak to you next Monday.
Peace!